You're listening to the Pandemic Podcast. We equip you to live the most real life possible in the face of today's crises. My name is Matt Bodker, and I'm joined with two buddies of mine. This is a miracle, Dr. Mark Kissler. Here he is at the University of Colorado Hospital. He's back. He's come out of some dark place and able to reveal the surface of his own head for us and talk to us for a few moments. And then Stephen, our reliable, steadfast guy in his own little apartment there in Boston, epidemiologist at Harvard School of Public Health. How are you guys doing?
Good. It's good to see you, Matt. I missed your radio announcer voice. It's been a while since I've heard that. Yeah, it was good. It's good to hear that this morning again.
I'm glad somebody can enjoy that. Oh, man. Well, you know, we don't have a lot of time this morning because, you know, we'll start with Stephen only because that's the context, and then we'll move to Mark because I want to hear what's going on in your neck of the woods. But Stephen, we had to adjust for those of you who are listening. You're going to realize we're publishing this a couple of days late. Stephen's been at a conference, and in fact, he even gave a talk at this conference. I'm actually completely in the dark of this conference. I have no idea what's going on, what you're doing, Stephen. So can you fill me in, as well as the rest of the world, about what conference you're doing and then what talk did you give on?
Yeah, so I have been at the virtual conference on virus dynamics, which has been hosted by, interestingly, the Fred.
Oh my gosh, I tried to get a ticket to that one.
I know, it was they were sold out like within 5 minutes. It was crazy.
Man,
people were just like running
in
all over themselves. Yeah, so it's hosted by the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Institute in Washington and Washington State University. So interestingly, the Fred Hutch does a lot of work on infectious diseases as well, because the intersection between that and cancer is pretty hugely important. And so they're with this workshop, they're interested in how viruses behave within the human body, but not just SARS-CoV-2. A lot of this workshop historically has been around HIV. And in fact, a lot of the research on viral dynamics in general has been from HIV. So we've had to adapt a lot of the work that they've done over the past few decades to try to learn what we can about SARS-CoV-2. So the presentation that I gave, it was the very first one of the conference, so it was a little bit stressful.
Way to set the pace.
Yeah, something like that.
You probably made everybody feel just really bad about yourself.
I spoke about some of the things that we've talked about on previous episodes, where we've had some manuscripts that have come out too. Our collaboration with the NBA, so where we've been doing frequent testing in players and staff and vendors and family members with the NBA. And when we do that, we can see how much virus people have in their bodies if they do become infected. And using that, we can build mathematical models to figure how long the infection lasts and whether that changes depending on which variant they're infected with or whether or not they're vaccinated. So some of the things I was talking about in particular were the variants and the vaccines and how they affect how the virus behaves in our bodies. So the vaccine really helps clear the virus out of our bodies more quickly, but you can still produce quite a bit of virus if you do get infected. So that's been a big part of the reason why we've had some of these shifting guidelines lately, where now vaccinated people are still recommended to wear masks in indoor settings, these kinds of things. It's based off of some of these findings from measuring these viral concentrations in people over time. So we were just talking about those things, and the conference has been really interesting. It's been really cool to hear people sort of digging into some of these questions from a lot of different angles.
That's great. And is this, I'm guessing this is all behind like a paywall. There's no to access your talk down the road or anything like that.
Yeah, there was a conference registration that we had to put in. But yeah. I think that I should be able to get access to at least my talk. And so I'm hoping to post that somewhere after the conference is finished.
Great. So those of you who are listening, if you're interested, once Stephen gets it, I'll make sure we put into some notes, show notes of some episode, and we'll let you know. That's awesome. And is this still going on, Stephen? Are you done?
Yeah, it's today is the last day. So, yeah.
Okay, great. Are you skipping out right now, just bailing out of the conference to do this podcast, or is there a break?
Yeah, there's a break. It's actually, since it's hosted on the West Coast, it's on Pacific time. So it starts 8:30 a.m. their time, but 11:30 mine. Okay. So I've got another hour before the first session.
Okay, that's where the time crunch. Mark, let's head to you, because we haven't heard from you forever. And in fact, you know, as Stephen and I were meeting every other week, you sent an email to us saying, hey, there's some stuff I want to talk about. I mean, hearing about this at the hospital, talking to friends. So I know you got a lot on your mind, but I want to first hear what's been going on, A, in the hospital, since we haven't heard anything about that forever. And then B, before we started recording this, we started talking about your personal life and kids going back to school. I'm sure a lot of people would appreciate what's going on in that transition in the Kissler family and how that's being handled.
Yeah, for sure. So well, I can start there. So kids are back at school. It's a little bit of a different flavor than the end of last school year in that they've been treating COVID cases just a little bit differently and not shutting down the whole classroom for weeks if there's a like a case in the community that's related to a kid. And they're still doing masking in all the classes. As far as I know, as of a couple or as of a week and a half ago or so when they last reported, there's been no outbreaks amongst the kids at the school. And I think, you know, from just like an educational standpoint and from a consistency standpoint, they've been doing a really good job of keeping the kids in the classroom as much as possible and really supportive of that ongoing, you know, just the ongoing educational needs of the kids. So that's been good. And, you know, we feel pretty well supported as a family from that standpoint. What else is going on? Hospital life is kind of status quo right now. And so we've seen an uptick in the case numbers as we've approached the fall for sure. And now we're kind of, you know, it kind of goes up and down by the week. We saw more, our ICU had been a little bit more full. And so we've been helping out there a little bit. And some of that is because once patients are so sick that they need ICU level care, you know, often they're on a ventilator or high flow oxygen for many days. And so that just kind of creates a different flow for the patients. And therapeutics wise, we're still using, there's not been a lot of big changes. And so we're definitely still using the dexamethasone, which has the most robust evidence for mortality. But we're using remdesivir, you know, which again is more, it has less of a strong signal in the mortality realm than our other therapeutics. But that's something that we've been using in our institution. And then we also, for patients who get very, very sick, despite the dexamethasone, we are using the tocilizumab and or the baricitinib, which are those molecular kind of the monoclonal antibodies that help reduce inflammation and cellular signaling. And so those, they have some, you know, there's some nuances around who we use those for and when, but for the most part, I haven't seen a lot of big therapeutic changes, you know, in this cycle, in this latest cycle of COVID. And I think there's just an understanding and an expectation that as we approach the winter months, we are accustomed to seeing a surge in the winter related to respiratory viruses and things like that. And so we're expecting that, and that there's going to be sort of concurrent increase in COVID cases along with our other respiratory viruses. So we're preparing for that from a staffing standpoint, and our operations team is hard at work, you know, making sure that we're going to have enough teams to take care of all the patients that we see.
Great. Well, you know, before we get into some of the questions you had from a couple of weeks ago, there's two things I'm thinking about, given what you were just talking about. A, I'm just curious, in Colorado, have we seen any other increases of like viruses or like, you know, flu? Is that starting to uptick? Are we still kind of like on the, you know, the delay on that? And I'm curious about how that's going to pan out down the road next few months, because yeah, we could have a big flu season, or, you know, there's still a lot of people masking, obviously. And so it might have its benefits once again this year. So I think that's my first question too. And I forgot my second one, but oh yeah, the other one was about treatment. And about, you know, talking about this, we were talking about this Merck thing. And so I wanted to tie that into the treatment. But the first is, have you seen any flu-like symptoms surfacing here in Colorado?
The flu is definitely here. So we're starting to see some cases. And this is, you know, as expected. So here, you know, here we are beginning of October, yeah, sort of, you know, beginning end. And, you know, I think Stephen could probably speak more epidemiologically. There's also, you know, as we've seen and as we know, there's going to be some complex factors that intersect with influenza to determine whether this is bad flu season or a mild flu season. And I think it's hard to predict, you know, at this point. From a purely clinical standpoint, it's more a question of how do we, you know, how do we prepare and get ready? Because we don't know exactly what we're going to see. And I'm just kind of take it as it comes. This Merck thing is pretty interesting. And I haven't had the chance to do a deep dive on the evidence yet, though initial, at least in terms of the reporting on the initial study, quite promising for an outpatient treatment to prevent severe disease. So it's an antiviral medication. And so it would be mostly used in the outpatient setting. The conversation point, or they're marketing it a lot as sort of a Tamiflu for COVID. So this idea that, you know, you have initial symptoms and a positive test, and then you can use this Medicaid to help reduce the symptom burden, maybe shorten the course. And we've been using things like, there's certain, you know, monoclonal antibodies that they use in the outpatient setting as well for people who are at high risk to help reduce the symptom burden. But it seems to me that this would be potentially a big step forward in terms of having something that can be really widely available and act on the virus itself early in the course. So, Stephen, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, that's basically my understanding of it as well. It's one of the really exciting things about it is that it is, like you said, it's meant to be available at a time in the infection that we don't really have anything available for people. All of the therapeutic interventions that we have are either vaccines to prevent you from getting infected in the first place, or things that help you once you've already gotten to the hospital. And so this has been a really sort of critical gap in our therapeutic portfolio that we have for COVID-19. So I'm really encouraged by it. It seems like, from my understanding, the evidence of its efficacy was so good that they actually stopped the trial short because they couldn't justify not giving the people in the placebo arm the drug because it seemed to be so effective. So I think that's a very good sign, and we'll see. But I think that it's good news.
That's great. Now, you guys dropped this on me. I had no idea. So a couple things that maybe you just said, and maybe I was just tuning out and thinking about my next question, which I can sometimes do. I apologize. But now, is this an over-the-counter prescription thing that you just, is it over-the-counter prescription? And how quickly would this be available? Is this still a ways away before it could become to the masses?
I'm actually not sure about that. It would be a prescription drug, so you would need to have some sort of healthcare encounter to get it. But I think that probably the two hurdles standing in the way still are FDA approval. So they've shown the evidence of the efficacy, but still needs to be approved. And then once that's done, then the production. So it'll still be a little while, but hopefully not too long.
Great. Well, we'll keep that in mind. And if I see anything in the media about it, I'll put it in the show notes for this particular episode. So, Mark, let's get back to you now because you had some questions. I'm glad you're here, Mark, because I feel like, I'm the most reclusive right now. I live in a tunnel, in a cave. First, it was Steven. I actually worked someplace, went to a building, dealt with a lot of conspiracies on a regular basis, and I no longer work there. And I really don't talk to very many people but me and my wife and my kids, who were kind of all on the same page on some level. So, but you're out in the hospital. You've been engaging a lot of people. Mm-hmm. You know, you've had some pretty strong encounters. Mm-hmm. So talk about that to facilitate some of this kind of conversation about the vaccine hesitancy and just dealing with all these prescriptions of lockdowns and masks.
Yeah, I think that's good. I agree. I think I've been the least reclusive of the trio here, and kind of, out and about, both at work and in our community, It's an opportunity for, I think we've had some interesting conversations with folks that I'm close to, both at work and outside of work, around a couple specific things. And so the questions that have been coming up at this point for me fall in generally kind of two categories. And so I'm going to say actually three categories, because you brought up the Illum home testing thing recall. And so that in the pre-show when we were talking about that, that's kind of thing number three. Topic number one that we've been talking about a lot is our vaccines yet again. And so breaking down some of the various reasons for people not getting vaccines, and in particular, getting a lot of questions about, people say, well, if I've already had COVID, what's the utility of getting the vaccine? And then conversations around who do I trust, and how do I get sort of to the preponderance of evidence that the vaccine is the right thing? And, I think we've seen this a lot there's different angles that different media outlets have used to report on vaccines. So some have been widely publicized cases of young people dying who are unvaccinated. And that takes on a certain flavor when it's picked up by the media that I think can be, they have a sense of sort of a punitive or a shaming aspect that is really repellent to a lot of people, understandably so. And then there's this other sense of like, okay, how do we actually engage in reasonable conversations about the reasons? And is there a way to develop some certainty, or even marginal certainty, about are the side effects dangerous, and how do we weigh our communal responsibility? Anyway, so I've been getting a lot of ongoing questions still, particularly as different workplaces have rolled out vaccine mandates for their employees. And so what I've seen is that as different workplaces are saying, okay, we're coming up against a deadline. Often that coincides with the fall coming on and, expected surge. Then people are forced to say, okay, am I going to file for an exemption? Then if I am, on what grounds? And if I'm not, what's my relationship with my employer? Am I going to leave? Am I going to seek alternative employment? Things like that. And so it's really become real for a lot of people in this time frame, and mostly because of those employer mandates. So that's thing number one. That's been the topic where a lot of things have been swirling around. Topic number two has been a little bit of conversation around how do we evaluate how we did with the pandemic? And in particular, how do we look at epidemiologic evidence looking forward and knowing that there's going to be a point in the future in which we encounter, you know, rapidly spreading infectious disease again. And so I think, you know, we've experienced where there's just a lot of feelings that people have around mandates and statements by the CDC and things like that. And still a tremendous amount of feeling of there's been changing goalposts. We don't really know what's real. We don't know if these mandates were effective. And so what I'm interested in talking to Stephen about a little bit is how do we think about the quality of epidemiologic evidence? How do we really get a sense of what interventions were helpful and what interventions might we be able to forego in future pandemics and things like that? I think there's a certain amount of despair of knowing that I've been encountering people where it's just like, well, we don't. There's just no way to tell. And particularly because we can't do things like randomized controlled trials, you know, like we do for drugs when we're talking about these big social interventions. And of course, those big social interventions have been the things that have really impacted people in huge ways. And then thing number three is this question of, you know, the at-home testing, I think, has been really relevant. And people are trying to make wise decisions of like, can I go to an event if everybody's vaccinated? And do you test beforehand? And then with the Illume tests having a bunch of false positive tests, so how does that change our orientation towards home testing? Does it change? Is that a blip? Or is that sort of a indicator of the utility of these things to begin with? So I think those have been kind of the three topics that have been circling around. And then, you know, just to throw one more in the mix is the mental health burden that we've seen. And I think just as this pandemic has stretched on now from a year to now we're going on, you know, almost 2 years, and it feels as if we're still kind of digging ourselves out. I do think that there's a really significant burden in the community, people who are really suffering from things other than just infectious disease as this is going on. So those are the concerns that people have been bringing to me, the points of conversation. And I don't know, you know, we have just a few minutes, but maybe we want to kind of hit those, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 as we go and see what you guys think.
Yeah, that sounds good. I'm so glad you brought the most simple questions to the foreground because we didn't have a lot of time. So just really some surface level, just icebreaker topics. Okay, so maybe we should do this in somewhat of a reverse order because I feel like in light of time,
sure.
I think the Illume thing, the mental health, maybe not quite reverse because the mental health is a big bag of something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's handle Illume and what that symbolizes mm-hmm. and then work backwards from there and do mm-hmm. the Illume and then the question about the lockdowns from Stephen. So Stephen, this is your show now. A lot of great questions here. Let's talk about the Illume. So that was on my thing as well. Like, oh, is this a blip or are we changing our tune to maybe these aren't the best thing. It's causing more problems. So any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's tricky, right? So like we want these tests to be as accurate, meaning as sensitive and as specific as possible. So we don't want false negatives. We don't want false positives. And so I think that I'm still deeply convinced that rapid tests like the Illume test and especially like some of the others that are available, the Binax Now and many of the others that have not yet been approved in the US, but that have been approved in many other countries in the world, can be and should be a central element of our route out of this pandemic and sort of emerging from this 2 year long, you know, real burden that we've all been carrying. I think that the issue here is around how we use tests, because a test doesn't exist in isolation. A test gives you information about some specific scenario that you're trying to learn something about. So one of the things that you can do to adjust for these false positives is to include a verification test, which many of the tests already do. So there are very simple ways to get around some of these issues with false positives, false negatives that really enhance the accuracy of the tests. And the thing that we're lacking most is not good testing technology, but good testing protocol. People don't know how to use the tests. People don't know when to use mm-hmm. the tests. And the tests are very good if you know those things. But in the absence of that, the tests are useless, no matter how sensitive and how specific they are. So that's my mm-hmm. major frustration, is that even these tests that have lower, in this case, specificity, meaning they were giving some false positives, they could still be extremely useful if used in the right way. And so that I think is the issue. Yeah. We're trying to find a technological answer to something that is actually much more fundamental and in some ways straightforward.
Yeah. And I think just to specify, it's not by used in the right way, it doesn't mean there's a improper testing technique right. being used. But what I believe you're referring to is a sense of understanding this concept of what's my pretest probability. You know, do I have symptoms? What am I testing for? Then the test characteristics that are inherent to the test itself. And then that, you know, those two things actually interact to give you a post-test probability of actually having COVID. And so there's, you know, and there's other ways to, you know, to think about that. Like, what are the scenarios in which we're using these tests? But that, is that right? That you're meaning it's not that we don't know how to use the tests, but it's actually, we don't know how to operationalize them, you know, to make decisions.
Exactly. And right. And even like, what exactly are we testing for? So there's the pretest probability, there's the test itself. And then, you know, what are we going to do with this test once it comes out? Do I want to know if I have COVID and need to seek medical care? Do I want to know if I should send my kid to school or not? Do I want to know if I should like show up to a family gathering? And all of those things contextualize how you interpret the result that you get. And I think mm-hmm. that we have a pretty good sense of what to do in all of those different cases, but the communication around it has been pretty poor, at least here in the US.
That's great. That's helpful. It kind of, I don't know if it's this relevant, but it reminds me of this concept of like habit stacking, where like you're trying to build a good habit, and as an island, it's just not sufficient. You really can't get a good habit sometimes to get started. But if you stack them with other existing things, it actually elevates the probability that you actually can develop a good habit. I feel like this is like similar, like taking an, you know, a rapid test in and of itself is one thing, but to stack it with all the other things that help to surround its context and circumstances really elevates the effectiveness of the actual test. So to treat it as a one pill thing, it's just not going to be, its purpose is to be used in context, right? And so that's really helpful. Thanks, Stephen. I appreciate it.
Cool.
Okay, go ahead. Mark, do you have?
Oh yeah. I was just going to say, let's hit the next question around.
All right. You know, this is a big one. Lockdowns, even in my little basement, you know, where I'm, it still affects me. So when I talk to no one but myself and maybe a few people online, the whole concept of, you know, did lockdowns work? Are the masks working? And there's all this, quote, evidence that we get from the media of people who were fully masked and it spread like wildfire, or people, you know, that Mark, you were reading that really old article I sent to you guys from Japan mm-hmm. and about the existence of how without lockdowns, this is how they survived. That this was a while ago. This is well over a year ago when that article came out, maybe less. So I just wanted to propose it of like, you know, and Mark, you can reframe this a little more about mm-hmm. just how do we know what's effective, what's not, and how do we come to that conclusion as an epidemiologist?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I think that it's, this is a tricky question, and it's, you know, one that we've been grappling with as epidemiologists, as people who tend to deal with observational data as opposed to trial-based data all the time. But never has it been so central to our existence as humans in society. There was a lot of debate around this early in the pandemic as well, where there was even a split between sort of different groups of epidemiologists, some of whom did not think that we could justify things like lockdowns because we didn't have the sort of randomized controlled evidence to justify them. And others who were, and I and many of my colleagues tended to fall more into this camp, which was that we don't necessarily know what the effect of lockdowns will be, but we do know what the effect of COVID on a city, on a community can be. And we have sufficient reason to believe that this could very well be helpful in the immediate term. And so based on the precautionary principle, this is something that we should be doing even in the absence of evidence, and we should be collecting evidence as we go. But now we're in a very different situation where, you know, the pandemic has been spreading for quite a long time. In theory, we do have and should have some evidence on this. And in fact, we do, but it's far from straight. So we can look at the examples of some countries that had very strict lockdowns, very strong countermeasures. And many of them have had very few COVID cases. Their economies are doing very well. We can look to Australia, New Zealand, for example. There was the example of Japan, I think we were talking about earlier too. Yep. And different countries have fared very differently here. But on the other hand, you know, some we might contrast the response in Germany versus the US, which are actually quite different. I think Germany tended to have a much stricter response. They've been a lot quicker to adopt technologies like rapid tests and to use them in ways that I think are very sensible. And that has definitely helped. But also, you know, they're not in the situation that Australia and New Zealand are. They're much closer to the per capita mortality that we have in the US than you might expect, given the difference in the response between the two different places. So one of the big issues here is that just there are so many different moving factors, from individual culture and political response and just sheer luck one way or another. And all of these different things sort of play into making it really difficult to draw conclusions as to, you know, what is the dose response of a week of lockdown to reduce COVID cases. And that's the sort of evidence that we're never going to be able to have perfectly. It is something that it's an evidence base that we can build over time as we look back at the experience that we've had over the last couple of years and begin to disentangle it. But it's a messy process. And I mean, I really empathize with the frustration that many people have about, you know, like there's sort of this sense of futility and almost hopelessness that we can ever know for sure. And I think I empathize with it deeply because that's sort of where my entire professional life is situated. I feel that frustration every day. But I am convinced at this point that even if the quality of evidence that we might have is poor relative to something that you might have in a trial, it's not nothing. And I think that matters still.
That's great. You know, I think a couple of themes come out, you know, as I'm hearing you talk about that. I think one of them is, I think there has been a lot of frustration amongst people who, especially who are, I think, less inclined to support mask mandates, vaccination mandates, lockdown, things like that, at the use of this narrative of, you know, well, science says that, you know, XYZ. And I think that you draw some important nuance there, where that even within the scientific community, there's some conversations going on about how do we use these models to inform what shall we do? And it would be great. It's so tough because I think a lot of people feel as if they don't have access to the scientific knowledge, the models themselves, to the ability, you know, to really parse that such that it feels as if they can't participate in that conversation, you know, rightly, because it takes experts to do that. That's why you went to school for as long as you did, and your colleagues, and continue to learn, you know, out of school. And then what happens, and I think this ties to our last point around the vaccines, is that in that scenario, you know, in which I can't participate, you know, in this more nuanced conversation that really weighs the data, then what I end up trusting are local authorities, and local authorities that cohere to my, you know, pre-existing set of beliefs to a certain degree, right? And so I thought there was this great Newsweek article. I'm using this kind of by way of transition to our vaccine point, but Matt, you sent out this interesting Newsweek article about a woman who is, you know, very highly educated and articulate, and talked about the reasons that she is not vaccinated. And, you know, she was like, I believe that the vaccine is important. She wasn't categorically, you know, anti-vaccine, and believes in COVID and wants it to end, but laid out her reasons. What I found most interesting, you know, I think some of the reasons there, you can go point by point, and I feel like, you know, this would be somebody who you could have a really fruitful dialogue with, and who, you know, I might learn something from, and she might learn something from me about, you know, how do we weigh the relative risks of side effects, for instance, or how do we understand the evidence that she cited about people who are vaccinated still spreading COVID. You know, I think there's some really important nuance around that, and, you know, the way that the vaccine actually reduces the incidence of getting infected. You got to stack those probabilities. So we can talk about all that point to point. But where she ended her argument, I think, is the most illuminating thing, which is that it was in a conversation with her physician who she trusted, and she didn't get this unequivocal yes that you need to get vaccinated. And so for her, that crystallized, you know, all of these little factors, like a little bit, you know, frustration about the changing goalposts, or the perceived changing goalposts, and frustration about the CDC's messaging, and frustration about, you know, the government in various ways. But then it crystallizes in this local conversation and a local sense of who then do I trust? And I think that's, I don't know, I feel as if we're really encountering that in a lot of ways. And so, you know, as we know, there's just a lot of variability then in these local authorities, you know, variability in how valid their advice is, how evidence-based it is, you know, and I think just in the, your one's desire to listen to somebody, you know, based on a whole lot of issues that maybe don't have anything to do with COVID. And so that, I don't know, it seems to me that when I'm having these conversations about vaccination, you know, and some pretty real stress that people are experiencing related to work and vaccine, that it's often coming down to this sense of like, who's my local authority that I can trust around this to kind of cohere, you know, all these vague feelings that I have into something that's actionable. Does that strike you guys as right? Is that something you've been seeing too amongst, you know, friends or, you know, I imagine a lot of us have kind of homogeneous work environments or more or less homogeneous work environments, right? Where there's a lot of shared, you know, but I think for those of us who have friends, you know, or family that span these ideological starting points, I think this has been really relevant.
Yeah, I totally agree. I don't even think it's so much local authority, but if it's just authority in general, because like, you know, it's so easy. It depends on what, you know, what's kind of the fad of the culture. But like, you know, if it's football, you know where to go for your authority. It might be ESPN or whatever it is. Like you got your places to go to, like, where do I need to get my information of like what's happening? How do I make my decisions? That kind of stuff. But when it comes to, you know, a pandemic, this hasn't been a fad. We don't know where to look to. And the first thing I thought about, Mark, is like, where is like the NCAA brackets of epidemiologists? Like, you know, you have one mm-hmm. side and here's the brackets of here's one side, here's another side. These are all the professionals going at it, talking about how do we deal with a pandemic and begin to be able to digest it in a way and inform ourselves versus like, I have no idea if it wasn't for a random Facebook post by Stephen in like whatever it was, February of 2020, I would have no idea about any of this stuff, what an epidemiologist really does. And I would have been informed by just my lowest hanging fruit. And for me, since it's not in the forefront of my mind, it would be, okay, a doctor's a physician, so that's the end all be all. What do you think? I'm done, right? Mm-hmm. Had no mm-hmm. clue that there was another area. Mark, you did because you went to school for this, right? So virology and vaccinology, all this stuff, I had no idea. So it's just not even in the realm of how you even find this information. So I had to find the lowest hanging fruit.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, even just the idea of a bracket. There's this, we're so deeply committed right now in America to a competitive or kind of a conflict oriented that there are two sides, right? And I think they're one of the helpful things I think that the conversation around vaccine hesitancy is bringing up is this reminder that there isn't a uniform reason that people are not getting vaccinated. And there's not a uniform, you know, prejudice against vaccine, that it's actually is a lot, you know, there's a lot of things going on there, but also this characterization that there are two sides. We're so deeply committed to that and to these metaphors that we're using about, you know, that are fundamentally they're combat oriented metaphors. And we use that in all levels of our society right now to sort ourselves out, you know, and sure, maybe there's, I'm not a sociologist or, you know, an anthropologist. I'm sure there's a lot of strong tendency to sort ourselves in this way. I found it to be extremely unhelpful, you know, over the last year and a half, 2 years. And I think it would be great. One thing I'm interested in is how do we begin our conversations from a starting place that undercuts that metaphor that says like, let's not sort out where we stand before we engage. Let's engage about something real that matters and be really rigorous, intellectually rigorous about it. But that's often, I think, kind of pie in the sky. So
I think in some sense it is binary, but like, you know, for me, I can maybe oversimplify things, but like it's either in this situation, either the vaccine, get the vaccine or not vaccine. But then like in my mind, the brackets is kind of a good imagery because then from that, there's a narrative that plays out and that narrative gets mm-hmm. more complicated as you expand outward. There's more nodes, there's more things, there's more complexities for reasons why, because there's no one reason. There's, you know, I'm not vaccinated because of immune compromise or whatever, but then it keeps going further and further and further. And we find tons of different nuances to the reasons why, you know, there's the one extreme, the anti-vaxxers, and there's then there's the other ones are just like because of concern, not having the right information. And there's a myriad of reasons, right? Or those who'd actually take mm-hmm. the vaccine. There's tons of reasons why that. I mean, as you expand outward, that neural network becomes wider and wider and wider and wider, you know, but it seems as if there is some common thread that kind of unites those decisions to be able to find and discover. But that's kind of way, you know, mm-hmm. but not in, mm-hmm. not in a competitive sense. But.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm aware of the time. I'm aware where Stephen's got to be pretty quick. Is there something else that you guys wanted to chat about, or Stephen, that's on your mind as we've been thinking about this stuff?
Yeah, no, I think the only other thing, like just on that last point, to just echo that I've also experienced and spoken with a lot of people who have very diverse and, you know, well thought out reasons why they themselves might not have gotten vaccinated. And it really, you know, this is one of the, I think, difficulties. You know, I think about this as a statistician, as an epidemiologist, but I think it's also just a real human problem of like, how do we avoid flattening narratives? And it came to mind, you know, when we were talking about the role that the media has played in shaping some of the narrative around the pandemic. And I think, Mark, something that you had mentioned earlier about how there is this discussion going on, even amongst, about, you know, what should we do? And yet that somehow gets flattened and distorted as it reaches people who are not scientists, to make it seem like there's this monolithic scientific opinion on all things, which then becomes sort of more of a moral statement than a scientific statement at some point. And I think that it's really interesting. I don't know what to do with this, but I think that this is, you know, this is a deep issue in that, you know, I think both, you know, both the media itself, but also just the platforms with which we share information, can sometimes serve to amplify single messages to the detriment of more nuance within those messages, and make it seem like there is a single reason to not get vaccinated, and that a person who is unvaccinated falls into this very stereotypical category. And we can, you know, think about that with all sorts of different things that have arisen during the pandemic. One of the really interesting things to me about this is that there's also been this concurrent major shift within the scientific community to make our research and our communication more and more open and accessible. So there's a huge open access movement in journals. We post almost everything as preprints. There are many scientists keep blogs where you can directly access their thinking. Many of us have been publishing op-eds in different newspapers and magazines. And so basically all of this is to say that I don't understand all of the issues and why, you know, why some of this flattening takes place amidst this landscape where it should be much easier to have direct access to the people who have been thinking about these things for long before COVID-19 had a name. So I don't know what to do about this, but I do think that just maintaining this initial stance whenever encountering any new piece of information, that there's probably a lot of complexity that underlies whatever message you're hearing is probably a valuable thing.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think the last thing I just wanted to make another plug to kind of go, we didn't, of course, we're not going to break down this whole conversation around, you know, depression, hopelessness, social isolation. That's much bigger of a scope than I think any of us can really tackle. But I do think, just as a personal plug, if I would just encourage everybody who's listening to check on folks around them and just be aware that I think there's a lot going on underneath the surface for a lot of people right now. There's a lot of, and so just checking on people and making sure that we're not, you know, perpetuating this, you know, whatever distancing that we're doing to be actually, you know, interpersonal distancing as much as possible. So it can make a big difference, I think, to look in on somebody and to check in. So I just encourage everybody to be doing that.
That's a great way to end this, Mark. Thanks. You know, I kind of feel like at the beginning of, you know, March of 2000, we were kind of asking people, again, same thing, Mark, you're asking to check in on people, but it's almost in some sense a little bit more nuanced, where our habit was to be really open out and doing things, and we're being forced to being closed down. Now we've been closed down for a year and a half, almost 2 years. And this is the most subtle way, is that reaching out with the context of leaning into human contact again. It's like we built a reverse habit now. It's been so intense. Our initial reaction is to stay away. And I'm not saying that if you feel like your conscience is saying that, whatever that be, but to encourage ourselves to reach out, connect, and now fight the urge to be isolated and begin to try to find ways to re-encounter the world, because this is not going to end, at least this whole mental cycle, for a long while. So there needs to be another rehabilitation going on. So thanks for sharing that. Okay, that ends this episode. Glad to have Mark in. So thankful you could join us, and hopefully you can be more regular. I know there's a lot of things going on in your life. Stephen, so good to see you. Have a wonderful rest of your day, the conference. And for everyone who's listening, thank you for listening. please subscribe if you haven't subscribed. If you can join us to support us, patreon.com/pandemicpodcast, $5 a month can go a long way. One-time donations, Venmo, PayPal, all in the show notes. Please leave a review. We love them. It inspires us, keeps us going. And reach out to us, matt@livingthereal.com. I will immediately forward that on to Mark and Steven so they can be encouraged as well and even answer questions as they come along. Take care. Have a wonderful week. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. All right. Bye-bye.